Today's problem of the Middle East certainly originated in an act of faithlessness 4,000 years ago, when Sarah attempted to secure the fulfillment of a divine promise by carnal methods. Through her misguided action, two races came into being who were destined to disturb the world. For Abraham had two sons, one born of an Egyptian servant, the other born 14 years later of his wife. It was impossible for the home to hold the two, and in consequence of Ishmael's mockery at his brother's weaning, Hagar and he were cast out to take up their residence eventually in the wilderness of Paran in the south of Canaan. Ishmael subsequently married an Egyptian, and as God had foretold, became the father of 12 princes, as well as the one daughter who later married his nephew Esau. Before Hagar's son was born, God promised, "I will multiply thy seed exceedingly, that they shall not be numbered for multitude." And he later declared that he would make Ishmael a great nation. To Isaac, God promised specific territorial possessions, but no pledge of this kind was made to Ishmael. As foretold, Ishmael's descendants multiplied very quickly, and they inhabited the greater part of northern Arabia, from the borders of Egypt to the Gulf of Aqaba. The majority were nomadic in character and dwelt in camps. The some became merchants and settled down in walled cities. By a specific covenant with Abraham, God bestowed the land of Canaan upon his seed as an everlasting possession, and subsequently assured him that the chosen seed was not Ishmael, but Isaac. Although Israel's entitlement to the land is today strongly disputed by the Arabs, the divine pledge was quite specific and unambiguous, and it must eventually be implemented. History repeated itself in Isaac's case, and like his father, he had two sons with little love for one another. Because of Esau's murderous hatred, Jacob, or Israel, made his home some 20 years in Paddan Aram, in Mesopotamia, before returning to Canaan, finally to spend 17 years in Egypt. Esau settled in the area of Mount Seir, a plateau running from the Dead Sea to the Gulf of Aqaba. The original inhabitants of Seir were the Horites, and Esau, or Edom as he later became known, added to his wife the Horite princess, but it was not long before his descendants, the Edomites, had completely destroyed or absorbed the Horites. The hatred between the brothers was transmitted to their posterity, and centuries later, Ezekiel's prophecy referred to it as a perpetual hatred. It was evidenced repeatedly in history. When, for example, the Israelites left Egypt to make their way to Canaan, they sought permission to pass through Edom, but the latter quite unreasonably refused them entry. David brought the Edomites into subjection, but they still remained a thorn in the side of Israel. When later Nebuchadnezzar destroyed Jerusalem and carried Judah away captive, the Edomites and their mountain fortresses not only lifted no finger to help God's people, but delighting in the troubles of their neighbors, seized the opportunity of taking possession of the southern part of Judah, and, as Dr. Clyde Harrington has said, thereby intensified the already smoldering hatred between the Jews and the Edomites. The Edomites were never afterwards driven out of the land. Under the Persian regime, Edom became a province of the Persian Empire under the name of Idumea, the Greek form of Edom. Israel, Ishmael, and Edom were descendants of Abraham, but this common ancestry has produced animosity rather than fraternal affection. Ishmael's hatred of the Jew dates back to God's selection of Isaac in preference to Ishmael. Edom's antagonism is due to his supersession by Jacob. The Edomites and the Ishmaelites were close neighbors, occupying the adjoining country and intermingling with each other. Jeff Aaron says the people throughout this region so managed their interests, married and intermarried, that the Ishmaelites, Edomites, Midianites, Horites, Amalekites, Ammonites, Moabites, and other cognate tribes became known as the Westerners or Arabs, those who lived in or adjacent to the Wadi El Arabah. Today we know them as the Mehdites or Northern Arabs. The Himyarites who inhabited southern Arabia or the Yemen, and the Mehdites were ultimately fused into one people. In 325 BC, the Nabataean Arabs, descended from Nabaioth, Ishmael's eldest son, swept over eastern Idumea, taking possession of Petra, and within the next two or three centuries, it became difficult to distinguish between the descendants of Ishmael and those of Edom, although Idumea still remained as a province when the Romans took over Palestine. The father of Herod the Great and procurator of Judea was an Idumean. The modern Arab probably owed something to both Ishmael and Edom. In the 6th century BC, Cyrus authorized the Jews throughout the Persian Empire to return to Palestine, to rebuild the temple, and to restore the liturgical rites and ceremonies. When the Messiah came, his people were therefore in the land, but they rejected him. God consequently gave them up. In AD 70, Jerusalem and the temple were destroyed by the Roman army, and after Bar Kokhba's rebellion in AD 134, the Jews were banished from Jerusalem and forbidden to approach the city. They gradually drifted back, however, and lived in comparative peace among both Christians and Arabs. In the early part of the 7th century, Muhammad, who claimed descent from Ishmael, succeeded in bringing under his control the wild tribes of Arabia, and within 10 years of his death in AD 632, his followers had established a great Muslim empire ruled from Damascus. In AD 627, the Caliph Omar took Jerusalem. A few decades later, the first Dome of the Rock was built on the temple site. The Muslim empire lasted, with the exception of 90 years of Crusader rule and 270 years of Egyptian rule, until Palestine fell to the Turks in AD 1517. And remained a part of the Ottoman Empire for four centuries. Despite the fact of Israel's conquest of Canaan nearly 3.5 millennia ago, and of the long history of their occupation of that country, it is perhaps not unnatural that the Arabs, as the more recent inhabitants, should consider that they have some claim to Palestine. Nor can one ignore the divine promise that Ishmael should be a great nation, although this gives no entitlement to the land specifically promised to Israel. Throughout the 4 centuries of the Turkish regime, Arabs and Jews lived side by side, both chafing under the foreign yoke and yearning for the day when they could throw off the fetters and take unhindered possession of Palestine again. When Turkey entered the First World War on September 8, 1914, Britain was well aware of the Arab feeling and at once conveyed to them an offer of financial assistance if they rose against the Turks and joined the Allies. The Arabs informed Sir Henry Wathman, the High Commissioner for Egypt, that the price of their cooperation was the political independence of the Arab countries. They defined the eastern boundaries, but inadvertently omitted any reference to the western boundary, an omission which was subsequently become one of the principal causes of misunderstanding. Their desired independence was guaranteed, and accepting the McMahon pledge, the Arabs revolted against Turkey. Largely through the efforts of T.E. Lawrence, an army of 200,000 Bedouin was enlisted and took an active part in harassing and demoralizing the Turks. Hampered in the production of munitions during the war, the British sought a formula for the manufacture of acetone, and this was eventually provided by Dr. James Weizmann, a Jewish chemist. The price he asked for his help was a home in Palestine for his people. And on November 2, 1917, Mr. A.J. Balfour, the then Foreign Secretary, issued a letter stating that the British government viewed with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people and would use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of that object. The Arabs were stunned. It had been their clear impression that the Roman pledge to Emir Hussein of Mecca What was a herd of Palestine, although not actually mentioned, should be theirs. Although Britain maintained that this was never intended, the Arabs were bitter in their denunciation of the British action. In 1920, a compromise was accepted, as a result of which Faisal, one of Hussein's four sons, became Emir of Jordan. But this did not ease the situation very much. Although initially the Arabs got on quite well with a few Jews in Palestine at that time, tempers soon began to fray, and it was quite clear that no reconciliation of the Balfour Declaration and the McMahon Pledge could be found that would satisfy the Arabs. Since the solution seemed temporarily insoluble, Palestine was declared to be a mandated territory. In 1922, and the mandate was awarded to Britain, the Balfour Declaration being embodied in the mandate. The active hostility of the Arabs soon made itself felt, and atrocities of the most brutal character were committed. Over a period of nearly three decades, white papers galore were issued. The problem was investigated by individuals and by various bodies. Every possible proposal was made, but all to no avail. The views of the Jews and the Arabs were completely irreconcilable. A few years later, an entirely new factor was introduced in Adolf Hitler. It reduced people who had suffered persecutions in the past. These tribulations were completely eclipsed by their experiences in Central Europe in the 20th century. The Nazi policy was clearly complete genocide, and for the majority of Jews in Europe, escape seemed impossible. The national home in Palestine seemed a will-o'-the-wisp, although numbers did, in fact, find their way there. Arab opposition to the influx of Jews flared up into a revolt, which was quelled with difficulty, but armed bands of guerrillas continued to attack the Jews. The Haganah, an underground army of Jewish volunteers, rose up to defend themselves, and the terrorist organization of the Ergun's Way Lumi took full revenge on the Arabs for any injuries suffered. The inevitable imposition by Britain of restrictions on immigration was bitterly resented by the Jews. And after the Second World War, Jewish terrorism and sabotage added their quota to the unrest created by Arab violence. Finding the situation too difficult to cope with, in 1947, Britain referred the whole matter to the United Nations, who eventually proposed the ending of the mandate and the partition of the country. The result was an immediate outbreak of violence by the Arabs. Determined to put an end to her responsibilities, Britain announced that the mandate would be terminated on the 14th of May, 1948. And on that day, the Union Jack was lowered, and the High Commissioner departed, leaving the Jews to their fate. That same day, Mr. David Ben-Gurion, the Premier-elect, proclaimed the establishment of the Jewish State of Israel. There seemed little hope of the survival of the new state. From all sides, the Arabs attacked. The forces of Egypt, Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, and Saudi Arabia descended upon Israel with the avowed intention of exterminating the Jews. But to the amazement of the world, the little nation of 700,000 routed the armies of the opposing nations of 40 million people. The armistice signed in 1949 resulted in an uneasy peace, with sporadic outbreaks of trouble and border skirmishes. Arab infiltrators stole Jewish produce and equipment, dynamited buildings, destroyed property, and massacred Jews. The Arab nations imposed an economic blockade on the little state, and Egypt banned Israeli ships from Suez and cut off entrance to the Gulf of Aqaba. In 1956, Egypt, Syria, and Jordan formed a unified army command for the purpose of war on Israel, and Iraqi forces began massing on the Jordanian border. In October, Israel mobilized her army, and without waiting to be attacked, crossed into Sinai to break up the Egyptian camps and to destroy the bases of terrorist gangs who were operating against Israel. An In a few days, the Jewish forces destroyed two Egyptian divisions and held most of the Sinai Peninsula. But for the ceasefire enforced by the United Nations, Egypt would have suffered a far more devastating defeat. The bitterness felt by Egypt of her humiliating defeat made a further attack upon Israel inevitable. And Radio Cairo repeatedly declared, "We're getting ready for the decisive battle, and at the right moment we'll strike with power and speed. All our coming battles with Israel will be battles of life or death." Over 1 million Arab refugees in the Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan, for whom repatriation and compensation have been repeatedly demanded, provided those countries with ample justification for war. The Jewish and Arab actions regarding the waters of the Jordan gave further provocation. Equipped by Russia with arms, tanks, and aircraft, the Arab states were all prepared in 1967 to wipe out the Israeli state. And when the outburst came, it seemed that nothing could save the little country. But the miracle of 1948 and 1956 was repeated in 1967. The Arabs seemed completely convinced of their own rights to Palestine and of the invalidity of Jewish claims to it. But as one writer points out, when the Arabs possessed the Holy Land at one time, there was never the sense of Arab at national life. A land of pestilential swamps and deserts for the most part, it was not a desirable place in which to live. Not until the era of Zionism brought young Jewish pioneers to Palestine, who at great cost and sacrifice drained the swamps, cleared the land, and made it blossom as a rose, did the Arabs pour in from the surrounding countries by tens of thousands to enjoy the better life that the Jewish pioneers had created. The Arabs then claimed Palestine as their ancestral home, started a controversy that became worldwide, and with the assistance of the nations who backed their claim, warred against Israel with the aim of destroying it that they might possess the land. The Jewish victory of 1967 is not the last chapter of the story, and a further military clash sooner or later is inevitable. A bitter hostility and a burning desire for revenge can only lead to an attack upon Israel by Egypt and her associates. Centuries ago, however, Psalm 83, referring to the enemies of God's people, said they have said, "Come and let us cut them off from being a nation, that the name of Israel may be no more in remembrance." Detailing the confederated powers opposing Israel, the psalmist included the Edomites, Ishmaelites, Moabites, Hagarines, Gebor, Ammonites, Amalekites, Philistines, Tyrians, and Assyrians. 10 nations are listed by Isaiah as destined for judgment. Babylon, Philistia, Moab, Damascus, Ethiopia, Egypt, Gomer, that is Edom, Arabia, the Valley of Vision, and Tyre. Jeremiah also contains denunciations upon several of the same nations. Even earlier, Balaam foretold the judgment of the Moabites, Edomites, Amalekites, Kenites, Assyrians, and the descendants of Eber, that is, the inhabitants of southern Arabia, Ammonites and Moabites, and so on. It is significant that the peoples named occupied lands now possessed by Arabs, and were themselves largely of the same stock. The future conflict and its outcome were therefore plainly portrayed in biblical prophecy centuries ago. Israel will unquestionably suffer a full-scale attack by the Arab countries, possibly in the near future, and the God of Israel will deliver her and will defeat all her foes. God has never promised Palestine to the Arabs, but he has made specific pledges to Israel, and in a coming day, the nation shall possess the whole of the land from the river of Egypt to the river Euphrates, as promised to Abraham. Psalm 108 makes it clear that certain towns of land, seized and held by Jordan, belong to God, and must inevitably revert to him, and consequently to his people Israel. In their unwavering hate